The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is Sunday, April 9th, 2017, the day after the main celebrations of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and parinirvana here at Hidden Valley Zen Center. And today I'd like to share with you something from a brand new book that's come out of the Dalai Lama's teachings. This is a different level of book of his. He has a lot of books in print at this point, but they're basically a little bit less deep teachings. And this is understandable because not everybody is able to access deep teachings. But in this one, he goes deeper, and this is important. Perhaps he's feeling the age that he's in, the urgency perhaps, because I think he's 80 years old, to get into some deeper public teaching than he has before in terms of the widespread teaching that a book can provide. And for whatever reason, this is a little bit deeper. And I would recommend the book. It's called The Heart of Meditation, Discovering Innermost Awareness. Discovering Innermost Awareness. In a way, that tells it all. Discovering Innermost Awareness. It's translated and edited by Jeffrey Hopkins from oral teachings that the Dalai Lama has given. And I'd recommend, if you haven't already seen the book, that you get a copy yourself. It could be quite helpful. He starts out in here by talking about how we're so interconnected electronically that in a flash, anywhere in the world, even if we're on a mountaintop these days, we can get up-to-date news, we can get up-to-date email, we can get texts and all the other electronic communication sources that people engage in quite a bit these days. It actually seems to be something of an addiction. And in fact, recently in the news, there was a report of a young woman who fell 60 feet off the tallest bridge in America because she was trying to do a selfie from a girder on the bridge, and she misstepped and plunged 60 feet below and broke a lot of her bones, which were going to require surgery, and was in pretty bad shape. She had to be airlifted to a hospital. I have no idea what condition she is in at this point in time, but I do know that when my older son was working on a Rolling Stones concert in Spain, that one of his coworkers, by that time Randy was in the ground supervision crew, but one of his coworkers, a Dutch friend, was up on the 80-foot high framework that created the basic stage structure, and they were taking down the staging. And there were two local men, one of whom was also belted in. They were doing things safely. They had safety harnesses. And there was another local man who had just reconnected his harness to the adjacent piece of structure. And unfortunately, our Dutch friend was not paying enough attention, pulled out the last bolt on the part that he and the other Spaniard were standing on, and down they went, that section of steel along with them. 80 feet they dropped, and they spent 45 minutes trying to resuscitate the Dutchman. And finally, he was pronounced dead. A amazingly, the Spaniard that was also there managed to fall into some very damp earth. It had rained a great deal, apparently, and survived, although it was said he would never walk again. He apparently has got a few now metal vertebrae in place of the ones that were shattered in the process. And I understand that when you fall from that distance, your bones shatter. And that may have been what happened to this young woman, that because ordinarily broken bones, well, they may require surgery, but there was a very definite point made that they would require surgery. And hopefully she will survive and not have a sufficient brain damage as part of the process to limit her life after that. But I dare say she will not be wandering out onto steel girders and the underpinnings of bridges to take selfies again. There are many, many, in some ways funny, but in another way really sad accounts of people walking off docks, walking into traffic, doing all manner of things because they were not paying attention, because they were stuck in their cell phones. It's endemic, and it is something that each of us who is connected to electronics these days, and that pretty much is 100% of us, has to row upstream against in terms of our Zen practice, because we are so accustomed to constant input that not having that constant input can feel anxiety producing. This is one reason why people keep their cell phones on all night long, which causes them to have interrupted sleep and a lot of other things. The first thing we need to work on is really focusing our minds, letting go our electronic toys long enough periodically, and that is frequently really, to be able to keep the original focus that we had as small children. When children are born, there's a certain point in time where a lot of what is technically called entrainment happens. They are connected with their caregiver in very deep and fundamental ways. And how the caretaker is involved with them teaches them how to be involved in the world. And that is another challenging thing that people are facing in this modern technologically connected universe that we're living in. That there was an article, a whole issue devoted in Psychotherapy Network or some years back to the challenge that children are having when their parents are so connected to their electronic toys that they essentially are ignoring the child. Or they'll, oh, what is it? What do you want? Go play with yourself, or something like that, is the response of people. I was in an office a couple of years ago, and there was a pair of parents and a little boy who was probably around 6. And both the parents, of course, had their faces in their cell phones, and the little boy was desperately trying to interact with them. And finally, he went over and got a cone full of water from the water dispenser in the office and brought it back and was sipping on it, and that was the only reaction he got from the parents was, "Stop that. Don't do that again." This is training our kids in a terrible, 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 terrible way. And we're going to inherit a world that is filled with chaos and negativity as a result. But back to the practice. This is one way we can counteract this move, by bringing our minds back to the practice as deeply as possible. And the Dalai Lama goes on a little bit deeper now. According to basic Buddhist insight, the mind is essentially luminous and knowing. The mind is essentially luminous and knowing. He continues, therefore, emotional problems do not reside in the mind's essence. Counterproductive attitudes are temporary, superficial, and can be removed. If distressing emotions such as anger were in the very nature of the mind, then from its inception, the mind would always have to be angry. Obviously, this is not so. Only under certain circumstances do we become angry, and when those circumstances are not present, anger is not present either. But it comes up for us. And it's part of the conditioning that inhibits our profound awareness of this luminosity. This luminous transparency. That are the qualities of this mind with a capital M that we are. The rest of it is conditioning. How to work with it? Well, things come up. First of all, a major part of the problem is an investment in a self-image, a self-centeredness that expresses itself many times over in our lives. The opposite is a humility, an awareness, an openness. But what do we do when we have this sense of me, I, popping up? Tune in. See if you can get a handle on the physical experience of that me, that sense of self. Stay with it. Open to the possibility that there could be something revealed in that presence. With that sense of self-interest, with that sense of me, and also with the anxiety that often can arise when we have such conditioning that we need to be in control. Tune in, feel it fully, truly fully, until it begins to dissolve and shift. And you will know that you have felt it truly fully if with this shift there is a sense of release and relief. It takes a lot of work to get to that point. There's an excellent book called Focusing by Eugene Genlin that can go a long way in helping us figure out how to do it. But it really is about becoming so present with the mind state that whatever obstruction seems to be there is so fully experienced physiologically, sensorily, that it dissolves and disappears. And in its place is a sense of deep okayness. It's not yet at that profound luminosity and transparency, but it is definitely a step in that direction. And it's important, it's vital in our practice to work deeply with these things. We all think, and certainly we've thought for a long time, especially those of us who've been doing Zen practice for a long time, the assumption has always been that, at least in the West, in America, you get yourself to a Kensho experience and then you're home free. Nothing else to do except gather kudos from all your admiring friends and carry on with your life. Unfortunately, that does nothing about the habit patterns of greed, anger, and illusion that only temporarily disappear when we have a Kensho experience. What Tore Inji, Hakuin's first Dharma successor, points out very carefully is that there's something called the long maturation, which is essential in our practice. Kensho is only the first stage. It allows us to see a little bit more clearly, but it's our responsibility to continue expanding that awareness and that clarity. And as it becomes more obvious where we are caught in habit pattern, where we are stuck in a self-importance role, to work with that, to let it go, because those are just parts of the illusion of being somebody. And they obscure this luminous transparency that we really are. This is vital work. We cannot say that we have reached any level of awakening, no matter how many Kensho experiences we have or had, until we have done significant work in this direction. He talks about what is this I that is being harmed, for example, in the sense that, you know, somebody's hurting us in by saying what they're saying or being against us or whatever. What is this I that's being harmed? We feel that both the subject, I, and the object, the enemy, are solid and independent. And because we accept these appearances as inherently established, anger is generated. However, if at that first flash of rage you make use of reason to examine, who am I? Who is this one who's being hurt? What is the enemy? Is the enemy the body? Is the enemy the mind? And this solidly existing enemy who previously seemed to be inherently created as something to get angry at, and this I who was inherently created to be hurt, seem to disappear, and the anger breaks apart. Think about it. We get angry at what foils our desires. Anger is fomented by the misconception that the object and yourself are established this way as enemy and victim in and of themselves. Hatred is not part of the mind's foundation. It's an attitude without a valid foundation. Continuing on, in another section, he's called Identifying the Mind. He reports his own experience. About 20 years ago, when I was in Ladakh, India, performing a series of meditations, I had a statue of Shakyamuni Buddha before me, as is still my custom. The gold leaf at the heart of the statue had worn away, and thus that area was brownish in color. Looking at the heart of the statue, which had no attractive color, watching my mind, eventually, thought stopped. And this is what can happen when we are truly, deeply focused. Looking at the heart of the statue, which had no attractive color, or we could say extending the out-breath, fully present. Watching my mind, being fully present. Eventually, thought stopped, and for a short period, I felt the luminous and knowing nature of the mind. It is very helpful in daily practice to identify the nature of the mind and concentrate on it. However, It is hard to catch hold of the mind because it's hidden beneath our own scattered thoughts. As a technique to identify the basic nature of the mind, first stop remembering what happened in the past. Then stop thinking about what might happen in the future. Let the mind flow of its own accord without the overlay of thought. Let the mind rest in its natural state and observe it for a while. When, for instance, you hear a noise, between the time of hearing it and conceptualizing its source, you can sense a state of mind that is devoid of thought but not asleep, in which the object is a reflection of the mind's luminosity and knowing. At such a point, the basic nature of the mind can be grasped. In the beginning, when you're not used to this practice, it's quite difficult, but in time, the mind appears like clear water. Try to stay with this state of mind without being distracted by conceptual thoughts and become accustomed to it. As we tune in to that luminosity, and when we do the extended out-breath, fully present with that experience over and over again, we reach a point where there's some subtle sense. We can gain a foothold by opening to catch it. The minute it starts to appear, because initially it'll be quite fleeting, stay there. And what opens up immediately after that, if we are able to stay fully present, is a clarity of mind beyond which we've not experienced before. This is a doorway into that luminosity and knowing. And then as we strive to stay present with it, what happens is suddenly it becomes two-dimensional. We have a picture of what that experience is like, because we've stepped out of it. To go back in, we need to tune in to the sense of two-dimensionality, to the full experience in our body, and it will open up again. Let's repeat once more what the Dalai Lama says. It is very helpful in daily practice to identify the nature of the mind and concentrate on it. However, it's hard to catch hold of the mind because it is hidden beneath our own scattered thoughts. This is why there is so much emphasis in traditional Zen practice of letting go our thoughts. In Japanese, it's termed cutting our thoughts, and we have to be careful about that terminology, because it's not about chopping them off at the ankles. It's about cutting our attachment to the thoughts. Thoughts will come and go, and as we give them no attention, gradually they will begin to fade. And then's our chance to step between thoughts and open to at least that clarity, with a potential of opening further, more deeply, to the luminosity and knowing, the luminosity and transparency. As a technique to identify the basic nature of the mind, first stop remembering what happened in the past, and then stop thinking about what might happen in the future. Let the mind flow of its own accord, without the overlay of thought. This is exactly how Einstein came upon his major discoveries. Let the mind flow without the overlay of thought. Let the mind rest in its natural state and observe it for a while. Practice this meditation in the early morning when your mind is awakened and is clear, but your senses are not yet fully operating. There is also a point as we are just beginning to wake up, and also the same point as we are beginning to drift into sleep, where that space between thoughts can be reached much more effectively, much more readily, much more easily. So as you wake up in the morning, that's another opportunity. Don't immediately jump out. Give your sense organs a chance to tune in, especially to this mind state where there's no thought yet. It cannot be described, of course, because it's beyond thought. Beyond thought means also beyond words. And this is another reason to let go of our electronic toys for significant periods of time. Because words or thought beget more words and thought, ever thickening the overlay of our luminous transparency. He continues, when you identify the nature of the mind as mere luminosity and knowing, hold on to that experience, the mere luminosity and knowingness, and stay with it by way of mindfulness and introspection. In other words, you're not just trying to hang on to a mind state. You're actively engaged in opening more deeply to that mind state, allowing yourself that mindset of openness to possibility, to see what might be revealed as you stay present with that experience. But as soon as you start talking about it inwardly or outwardly, you take yourself far, far away from the experience. And finally, he says, begin with yourself. Since it is the individual person who undergoes pleasure and pain, makes trouble, and accumulates karma, all the noise and the mess being made by the self, analysis should begin with yourself. This is so important. It's so important to look inward and not to blame what's going on in terms of our self-comfort on external factors, because they're not to blame. It's how we're reacting to what's going on that is the cause of our suffering. And Jacques Lucerne's experience in Buchenwald certainly underscores this. Then when you understand that you yourself are without this overblown status, you can extend this realization to the things that you enjoy, undergo, and make use of. In this sense, the person is the principal subject of analysis. Can you remember a time when you did something awful and your mind thought, oh, I really made a mess of things? At that moment, your sense of I appears to have its own concrete entity, which is neither mind nor body, but something that appears much more strongly, does it not? Or remember a time when you did something wonderful or something really nice happened to you and you took great pride in it. This I that was so valued, so cherished, so liked, and was the object of such self-importance was so concretely and vividly clear. At such times, your sense of I is particularly obvious. Once you catch hold of such a blatant manifestation of I, you can cause this strong sense of I to appear to your mind, and without letting the way it seems to diminish in strength, you can examine as if from a corner whether it actually exists in the solid way it appears. Up till now, self-cherishing and its partner ignorance have taken up residence in the center of your heart, despite drawing you into all sorts of actions in an attempt to bring you happiness. These attitudes have created many problems. You need to view self-centeredness as faulty from the depths of your being. Now is time to leave self-cherishing behind and take up cherishing others, to leave ignorance behind and take up the wisdom that realizes selflessness. Selflessness. In this profound luminosity and transparency, there is no room for anything else. Far less any sense of self. This self that we have been conditioned to protect and defend so strongly does not exist. But as long as we engage in nurturing it, acting it out, we cannot gain access to that luminosity and transparency that is the reality of who we are. It's this deep, deep practice. And one who is able to reach that mind state in an ongoing manner is only then truly free. I thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.